It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Tis the time for gatherings. It's the season of friends, foods, and fun, and lots of ways to pull them off, like how Chef Michael Solomonoff does it.
I want it to look like a party, so I like a bunch of little salatine, whether that's like raw tabbouleh, bowls of hummus and piles of bread, and then bowls of like different pilafs or grains or Persian rice that's sort of fragrant with saffron and dried fruits and almonds. And then, you know, I like the whole sort of lamb shoulder that's been glazed with pomegranates, whole roasted chicken, pickles, and, you know, people rolling up their sleeves and sort of bumping elbows and passing things and taking little bites and even double dipping sometimes with their spoons and forks, to me, is a good party.
Feasting, the art of port, and in the kitchen with Nigella Lawson, this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Britain's Nigella Lawson stepped away from her journalism career in 1998 with her best-selling book, How to Eat. Smart, funny, and beautiful, she's a food writer that writes about the pleasures of food and the ways that cooking can be not only delicious, but therapeutic. Her latest book is Simply Nigella, Feel-Good Food. Nigella, great to have you back with us.
Lovely to be back.
You know, looking at this book, and I got involved reading it, and I realized this feels so personal to me, the reader. And there's this pervading sense of calm in the book. This just feels so intimate. It feels like, you know, we're restoring ourselves together. Where did that come from?
Well, you know, I think that writing about food and talking about food is always intimate. I think we all have a very intense and personal relationship with food. And as long as a writer is being honest and authentic, we always sense that. And I enjoy the conversation around food. And because of that, I allow quite a bit of time to talk at the beginning of each recipe so that it's a bit like settling down. You know, I want to settle down with the reader and talk. And in my mind, there's a conversation and a response. But I think all my books are personal. And I do feel that the recipe is, for me, is a very highly charged autobiographical form. It's like a diary entry. The recipes I cook and then write about, it's almost like writing a journal. It feels like that.
Well, the recipes read like that. You say that when your first book came out, the editor branded it in her mind as being, what was it, the masala?
The pea masala and rhubarb cookbook.
Yes. And you say this one is the cold-pressed coconut oil, ginger, chili, and lime cookbook.
It is, although actually there's an awful lot of extra virgin olive oil, which I regard as the elixir of life.
Well, I have to say, this is a quartet that I, too, am addicted to. Let's talk specifically about some of the things you do with it.
Well, I add it to soups. For example, I've got a sweet potato, orange, and ginger soup, because much as I adore a sweet potato, I find that unmediated, the sweetness is too much. So citrus and that heat of ginger is just perfect. And I also love the sort of fuzzy nubbliness of an old-fashioned chickpea soup that perhaps is not heavily seasoned. Mm-hmm. I thought I wanted to bring a bit of brightness and light to it. So I added some of the flavorings of maybe like a Thai hot and sour soup. And I again added lime and chili and ginger. And I also found this wonderful way of getting ginger to be even more dominant, which is I peel my ginger and I use a teaspoon for that, because, you know, if you use a knife, you just waste most of the ginger
root.
And then I grated it and then put it in a bit of paper towel and made a little swag bag, like making a tea bag, I suppose, and then squeeze, and this incredibly intense ginger juice comes out. So even though I might grate ginger and put it in a soup, at the end, if I want to add more, I just make this ginger juice. I also use it, you know, I've got a bundt cake that's cider and five spice. So it's a bit like gingerbread, only the slightly more of a perhaps aniseedy licorice note because the five spice does that. And also an awful lot of fresh ginger. The fresh ginger really adds a different sort of heat. It's somehow rounder.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be used in sweet and savory. And, you know, I have to really think of a reason why not to use it.
You mentioned something that sounds delicious, but something you mentioned about cooking yourself strong.
Yes, I think for me that I find the act of cooking itself restorative. But it has to be very simple, because at times when I'm either overworked or stressed or generally depleted, I don't really want to feel I've got to concentrate so much and worry about whether I'm doing something right. So a little light stirring, maybe some chopping, but generally something that is cooked quickly and I suppose has ingredients in it that make my body feel strong and full of good things. And for some reason, my body told me to eat sweet potatoes, and I obliged. But also, you know, quite a bit of broccoli, cauliflower. I started roasting chickpeas and cauliflowers, or really more baking them together. And once you have cooked cauliflower in the oven, there is no turning back.
Right.
And
right.
These simple rituals of just chopping a cauliflower, tossing it in a bit of oil and spices, putting it in the oven, and while that's in the oven, opening a jar of harissa and turning some chickpeas and some sliced up tomatoes, and then adding that.
Mm.
And then I'm getting myself ready, I'm calming myself down, I'm feeling ready for my supper, I can smell it. And then I just make a simple warm salad with, I use parsley, like a salad leaf, flat leaf parsley, uh-huh, as a garnish, and then, because I think beauty is important in terms of how one feels in life generally and in the kitchen. A bit of aesthetic uplift never goes amiss, and sprinkling pomegranate seeds and that tang.
Mm.
And not only do I have supper, but I have enough left over for lunch the next day. And that's important too. I think that, you know, we're aware that cooking for others is an act of generosity or kindness, but it's really important, I think, to be generous and kind with oneself. And that, for me, was an essential part of making this book.
Tell me your feelings about the term clean food.
Well, I feel that I sound like I'm getting rabid on this, but I don't like the term clean eating or clean food because I hate the notion that's implied that other forms of eating are dirty or shameful. I hate food shaming. I also think that no one makes a good decision out of negativity, so you make people feel bad about what they eat. It's just going to compound the issue. And obviously, I agree that eating real food and not processed food is good and better for one. But I do feel that a lot of clean eating is too restrictive in its approach. There are so many foodstuffs taken out that it becomes a very narrow-minded and almost self-persecuting way of eating. But I don't really have anything against the food itself. I just don't like it if I think there are punitive implications, either mm-hmm. to oneself or to other people. I think that food is there to be celebrated, and by celebrating food, we celebrate life. And if you try and take that away or erode that in any way, then life and oneself, you know, we are both diminished.
Nigella, thanks so much for talking with us.
Always a pleasure, Lynn.
Nigella Lawson's latest book is Simply Nigella, Feel Good Food. She left us with a recipe for warm cauliflower and chickpea salad. And you can find it, you know where, splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern coined that phrase road food with their first guidebook to America's down-home eats. Now, that was in the 1970s. Well, they're still at it, unearthing dynamite local finds for their website, roadfood.com, and for us. Jane, Michael, welcome back, guys. What's up?
What's up is what may be the most wonderful cup of hot chocolate anywhere. This is hot chocolate as served at L.A. Burdick. It's a candy store in Walpole, New Hampshire. Actually, with branches in New York and Boston, but the Walpole, New Hampshire is the main one. They make a hot chocolate there that really is the most chocolatey thing I've ever had. I mean, it's made with simply, you know, chocolate shavings and steamed milk. It's like a steamroller of chocolate. I mean, one large cup, it's almost impossible to drink the whole thing unless you also have a lot of their Gugelhopf and Linzer Tort on the side to kind of balance it.
You know, on the way to the studio, because I knew we were going to be talking about hot chocolate, I stopped at three franchise places along the highway whose names I will not say, and I got a hot chocolate. And I am truly ready to drive to Walpole, New Hampshire at the moment, because once you've had one of these velvety chocolate concoctions, nothing even satisfies.
Well, what's nice is you can get either the milk chocolate version, which is like unbelievably creamy, you know, very Swiss in nature, or you can get the dark chocolate version, which is, I mean, it's like a steamroller. It's like if you love chocolate, this is nirvana. Because it's so intensely chocolatey. Honestly, I had a large cup. I couldn't finish it.
And not super sweet, which is...
No, not at all.
It's wonderful.
So, do they have other things other than hot chocolate?
Oh, yes. Great pastries. They have Gugelhopf, which is that classic Austrian-Swiss bundt cake. Very perfumey with lemon and vanilla, and it goes beautifully with coffee or hot chocolate. They have very good cherry danishes, and they have Linzer Tort, which, again, is something you can find in pretty many bakeries, but you don't find the wonderful version with the freshly made raspberry jam and rich with flavors of hazelnuts and almond, vanilla, cinnamon, cloves in the shortcake pastry.
Yeah, the pastries and the hot chocolate, and they have espresso drinks as well. It's all very sophisticated, but in fact, it's a small-town chocolate shop. As sophisticated as the products it makes are, it's a very cozy... You know you're in Walpole, New Hampshire when you're eating here.
And you eat there, right?
Oh, yeah. They have tables. You know, it's a tea room is what it is. And there are tables set out with... they have, like, you know, brown paper cloths so they can, you know... get the dripped hot chocolate off very quickly.
Do you remember, Michael, what the girl at the counter said to you when you walked in?
No.
She said, have a mouse on the house.
Ah,
and she gave you a little chocolate mouse to eat, which was adorable.
Sounds like a great place for sugar shock.
And chocolate shock as well.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
You can find Jane and Michael's picks at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the art of Spanish chef Ferran Adrià and serious celebrating Israeli style. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The name Ferran Adrià has become synonymous with titles like the world's greatest chef, culinary genius, the father of molecular gastronomy. He's the man who brought foam to the restaurant world. More important, he first started rethinking how we experience taste. And he did this during the years that he ran El Bulli, the restaurant on the remote Catalonian beach that became a culinary mecca. His work transformed the art of cooking into the art of food. So it's not far-fetched that Chef Adrià's work has been turned into an international art exhibition called Notes on Creativity. The exhibit is built around the hundreds of notebooks that he and his team filled with ideas, collaged photos, and sketches of the, would you believe this, 1,846 new dishes created at El Bulli. Our producer, Jennifer Russell, talked with Ferran and his interpreter at the Minneapolis Institute of Art.
It is such a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
So here we are in this gallery, in this beautiful exhibition filled with your work. How do you want people to experience this? What do you want them to learn about you and your work?
Lo que quiero es que la gente reflexione.
What I want is for people to reflect on it, to
la
think.
La gente casi nunca
People hardly ever reflect on the fact that things have been created in cuisine. No. Anything that we eat was at some point created. Everything does. These pictures here?
Aquellos era para visualizar.
Those were for visualizing.
Desde el Big Bang.
From the Big Bang.
Al Neolítico.
To the Neolithic.
Toda la evolución que ha habido en la comida, en la cocina.
The whole evolution that there has been in food and cuisine.
O habría un momento de duda en cuándo empieza.
So we can't really agree, or there would be certain doubt as far as deciding when is it that cooking starts.
Se va a su casa y come una manzana, bueno, y se la come, eso es cocinar.
So if you go home and you eat an apple, is that cooking?
Para mí no.
For me, that's not.
No, porque no hay la aptitud de cocinar.
Because there's no aptitude as far as cooking goes.
Puede ser gastronomía.
That might be gastronomy.
Porque si quieres comértela con placer.
Because if you want to eat it and enjoy it, make it pleasurable, because it might be a really good apple, there might be some gastronomy aptitude there.
Pero si esta misma manzana.
But if you were to put that very same apple on a plate.
Para mí esto es cocinar.
For me, that's cooking. And in that very fine line right there, that's where we could say that cooking really starts. Because cooking is transforming the food to make it more pleasurable. So when did cooking start? When did it really start? Was it 2.5 million years ago when the Homo habilis came? Or when did it really?
O hace un millón de años cuando...
Or did it actually start a million years ago with fire?
¿Cuándo empezó?
When did it really start?
¿Cuándo podríamos cocinar más o menos parecido a hoy?
When was it that we were able to cook mostly in a similar way as we cook nowadays?
¿Cómo podría hervir, freír?
How could you boil? How could you fry? How could you stew?
La cerámica.
Ceramic.
Hace muy poco.
Not very long ago.
8,000 años.
8,000 years ago.
Sí, una sola tecnología.
A technology.
La de hacer.
The one that you use to make these containers.
Muy simple.
It's very simple, right?
Cambió la historia de la gastronomía.
But that's what changed the history of gastronomy.
Tanto como el fuego.
Just as much as fire did.
Ajá.
You are known for transforming the world of food. But how do you define your food and your cooking? Well, first of all, the most important part about bouillie is that we have made people think.
¿En relación con la cocina?
In relation to cuisine and gastronomy. It's pretty clear that we're supposed to eat organic food, right?
No, organic no.
No, I'm sorry, natural food.
Natural food, okay? Y que un tomate orgánico...
And so it's clear that an organic tomato is a supernatural food, right? Product, right?
Sí. Right. Mentira.
That's a lie, though.
Esto es objetivo. Por esto cuando hablamos
this is objective.
Natural es lo que está en la naturaleza sin que
so something natural is something that's in nature, but the human being has not touched it, though.
El tomate natural está en los Andes.
The natural tomato is up in the Andes.
Es incomestible.
And that one you cannot eat.
Es malísimo.
It's super bad.
El 99% de los
99% of the natural vegetables are not edible.
El tomate orgánico
the organic
es lo
tomato
natural.
Is the least natural thing in the entire world.
Porque se ha hecho,
because
¿vale?
It has been made, hombre, right? I mean, man has participated to make it a better product.
Esto es lo que hizo el bouillie.
So that's what bouillie did. Okay, so I have a question about el bouillie. People consider those meals amazing, their most memorable meals ever, the idea of having 20 to 40 courses. And I guess I want to ask Ferran what he wanted his diners to come away with from that experience.
Well,
first of all, bouillie was probably the first restaurant in history that had people that hated it. Why? Because we took that experience to the limit.
El bouillie cocinaba para abrir caminos.
We cooked to open new paths.
Y hacerte reflexionar.
And to make you reflect on things.
Necesitabas un promedio de 5 horas.
You would spend an average of 5 hours sitting down at bouillie.
Y a veces 6, ¿eh?
And sometimes even 6.
Pero no comiendo todo el tiempo.
But it wasn't just always eating all the time.
Fíjate, 6 horas viendo un museo.
Can you imagine spending 6 hours watching a movie or at a museum? 6 hours.
Y con un nivel de concentración muy, muy alto.
And with a very, very high level of concentration.
Claro, hacía que, y hace que el bouillie
this saw made bouillie a very strange thing.
Cuando podemos seguir hablando.
We could spend another whole hour talking about strange things at Buyi.
Si no contestas esto, dicen, bueno, estos están locos.
So, I mean, really, without context, people might think these guys are crazy.
La gente más lógica.
But no, we were actually the most logical people that you could ever imagine.
Y ahora con la fundación.
And with the foundation, we're following the same path now.
¿Qué es? Preguntarnos por qué, por qué, por qué.
And the whole thing, it's about asking ourselves why, and why.
So you did not dream of becoming a chef. You didn't particularly love to cook or love to eat. And here you are, and your brother is a brilliant chef as well. How'd you get here?
It just happened, but it's a great reflection.
Y que al ver, mi hermano, también pasó.
And the fact that it happened to my brother Albert too, that's amazing too.
Seguramente hay pocas personas.
And there are probably very, very few people that in their discipline have had such a strange career.
Porque normalmente alguien empieza una disciplina.
Because normally you start in one discipline and you work really hard so you can go really far.
Nosotros no.
We didn't.
Un año.
We started cooking thinking that we would last a year.
Siempre el porqué de las cosas.
And maybe that's why we always ask ourselves why about things.
Yo mismo sé contestar esta pregunta.
But it is true that even myself, I'm not able to answer this question.
Hmm. It was such a pleasure to meet you and speak with you. Thank you.
Ferran Adria's Notes on Creativity is showing at the Minneapolis Institute of Art. Now, for more information about the exhibition and Ferran's El Buyi Foundation, head to our website, splendidtable.org. Chef Michael Solomonov has spent his life living and traveling between two countries, Israel and the United States. With strong roots in both places, he's become a leading interpreter of Israeli food. Americans flock to his restaurant, Zav, in Philadelphia for the authentic dishes of Israel. But also, as he explains to our contributor, Patty Hinnich, they come for the style of what it means to eat Israeli.
Michael, so lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's great to talk to you.
Can you tell me a little bit about your connection to Israel?
You know, I was born there and I grew up here in the States. And then when I was 15 or so, we moved back to Israel. I stayed for a year and went to a boarding school there and then moved back to the States and then dropped out of college and moved back to Israel for a year. And that's where I learned how to cook. So I worked in like a little bakery and then I worked in a cafe and then I went to culinary school in the States and... That's it. Over time, I just think that cooking and being interested in Israeli cuisine, it's sort of grounded me a little bit. Israeli food is represents all the people that make up Israel. So there's Iraqi, Iranians, North Africans, Yemeni, Greek, Cyprus, Bulgaria, Romania, Europe. I mean, all of Europe.
Can you define any common denominator that would describe, or explain to a foreigner what Israeli food is, given that there's so much diversity within it?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple sort of principles. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are exceptions to all of these, but the heavy use of tahina throughout Israel is very, very important because tahina is sort of the way to sauce meat without being non-kosher. Right.
Oh,
so if
right.
you add like yogurt or if you add like any other dairy product or cheese, it's like you can't, you don't really serve meat with it. So that one thing, the heavy use of tahina, the indigenous olive oil, the bitter herbs and the spices that sort of make up, cooking in that region. But I mean, cuisine is in motion all the time, whether we sort of know it or not. It's always sort of changing. It's always evolving. People are adapting and transporting and, sort of transcending food. So it's really difficult, especially in a place like Israel, which is sort of like the cultural crossroads for many different people. It's hard to pinpoint a few things that make up Israeli food. We always joke in the kitchen whenever somebody asks me to taste something, they're like, what's it need? Olive oil, lemon, and parsley? there's a lot of that,
Right.
Israeli food is very vegetable forward, very vegetable heavy.
Right.
you know, not relying, you know, entirely on like tons of proteins. So
right. I had the opportunity to eat at your restaurant recently with my husband and my boys, and the moment we walked in, we felt like a feasting and feast environment. So the way the food is served and everything is shared, and there's some like contagious enthusiasm and happiness and generosity about the way the food is served and how it's shared. Do you think that describes or defines a little bit the Israeli way of approaching food?
I mean, I think it's a sort of a mentality in which you eat. The spirit of sort of rolling up the sleeves and breaking bread together is something that we try to emulate at the restaurant. We want the customers to feel that. We want we want to make memories. And I mean, food, of course, has to be very good. It's about the company. It's about the style in which you eat. It's about the holiday that you share. It's about the traditions. You know, I think that, eating is such a huge ceremony.
Absolutely. And
for everybody. I mean, it's common.
Yeah. So you're the perfect person to talk to about how to put together a feast. How do you like to set the table and what you like to put on the table?
Well, I think cooking and dining is festive, right? So I like things that are bright and not just like aesthetically bright, you know, like our sort of like turmeric stained pickles, but, you know, the sweet and the sour, you know, and sort of the vegetables. I want it to look like a party. So I like a bunch of little salateen, whether that's like raw tabbouleh, you know, chopped parsley salad, sort of like a stewed tomato compote called matbucha, you know, which kind of goes with everything, or eaten by itself, bowls of hummus and piles of sort of bread or pita or laffa, you know, the fluffy sort of Iraqi pita, and then bowls of like different pilafs or grains or, you know, bowls of Israeli couscous or Moroccan couscous or Persian rice that's sort of fragrant with saffron and dried fruit and almonds. And then, you know, I like the whole sort of lamb shoulder that's been glazed with pomegranate. Whole roasted chicken, also sitting on laffa, this puffy sort of Iraqi-style pita, you know, with tahina sauce and pickles and whole fish, too. We wrap whole fish with grape leaves and then grill it. And I don't know. I just think that sort of way is fun to eat. You know, people rolling up their sleeves and sort of bumping elbows and sharing pieces of bread or passing things and taking little bites and even double dipping sometimes with their spoons and forks, to me, is a good party. That's what it should be. I don't like things to be overly refined, and certainly not in my house.
Michael, it was so great to talk with you today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Michael Solomonov is the author of Zav, A World of Israeli Cooking. Patty Hinnich is host of Patty's Mexican Table on PBS. Now, Michael left us with some centerpiece recipes to plan a feast around. Find his recipe for Zahav lamb shoulder and whole fish wrapped in grape leaves. Doesn't that sound sensational? It's all at splendidtable.org, with lots of other holiday menu ideas. So do a little browsing on the website and be sure to sign up for our giveaway. That's splendidtable.org. You know all those classic English scenes where the ladies retire to the drawing room after dinner while the men stay at the table smoking cigars and drinking port? Well, all those genteel English women were not missing out on the cigars, but they were certainly missing out on that port. To my mind, port is one of the most overlooked wines, and if ever there was a time of year to track some down, this is it. Our contributor Noelle Carter sat down with award-winning wine writer Karen McNeil to find out exactly what we need to know.
Karen, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks, Noelle.
You know, now that we're in the thick of the holiday season, port seems to be one of those things that's perfectly suited to this time of year. For those of us that are new to port, could you explain what it is and where it comes from?
Yes, port is a fortified sweet wine that comes from northern Portugal, specifically from the Douro River Valley. And that's the only place in the world where true port is made.
And what is it fortified with?
It's fortified, Noelle, with natural grape spirits. So it's really like a clear brandy that is added during the making of the port to raise the alcohol level just a little bit. And often those spirits are made with the very same grapes that the port itself is made from. Port is very delicious, but it takes a little bit of understanding before you buy it, because depending on how you count, there's anywhere from 6 to 10 major styles. Shall I tell you about the two top styles, though?
That would be wonderful.
Yes, because I think it's probably true for any of us today, if you're going to have this, you know, a bottle of port for Christmas or the holidays, you're probably going to focus on either tawny port or vintage port. And here's the key question you have to ask yourself. Would you rather have creme brulee or would you rather have chocolate cake? Because tawny port has flavors very similar to creme brulee, all that sort of caramel, brown sugar, cream, custard, those sorts of flavors. Wow. Whereas vintage port is very chocolatey, very berry, very deep and complex in the way that dark chocolate is. So those two main styles of port are radically different, and they are both delicious. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that makes it so fascinating and fabulous during a holiday meal is that it often is the perfect way to end a big, rich meal. So maybe instead of dessert or just one little bite of, you know, your favorite holiday pie, a small glass of port is so sumptuous. And it can have all those flavors.
It just sounds wonderful. You know, I can't wait to go out and pick up a bottle or two for gift giving. Are there any particular labels that you might recommend? And how much should I plan on spending for, say, a decent bottle of port?
Well, for a tawny port, probably we're talking about $35 to $50. And remember, usually people serve small amounts of port, no more than 2 ounces. So, because it is so concentrated. So a bottle of port is going to serve 12 people. So one bottle will, in fact, go a long way. With vintage port, because vintage port is the top port and it is often given as a gift, I think you should count on anywhere from $100 to $200 or sometimes more if you buy already a very old vintage.
Are there any particular names or labels that that you would recommend?
Yes, I love the ports of Graham's, Dow's, Wars, Taylor Fladgate, very famous vintage ports that are delicious. And then smaller producers like Quinta do Vesuvio. When you see the word Quinta, it translates to farm in Portuguese, but it means that the wine came from one very small prestigious estate. So Quinta do Vesuvio's vintage ports are also phenomenal. Smith Woodhouse. You know, in fact, there aren't all that many great port firms left. They've consolidated over the years. And the ones that we get here in the United States are almost uniformly the very top ones. So luckily, you almost can't make, in fact, I would say you cannot make a mistake. Any true port from Portugal on a shelf in the United States is, in fact, one of the 20 great brands in the world.
That's great to know. Now, let's say for some strange reason, I don't finish the bottle of port at the night that I serve it. How long will a bottle keep after it's opened?
Port will last quite a long time. If it's tawny port, it will last, you know, easily a month or more, 3, 4, sometimes even 5 months. Vintage port, it depends on how old the wine is that you're serving. If you're serving a wine from the 80s, it would probably last, a week maybe. If you are lucky enough to have a really old, wonderful port, like the famous 1970 version, vintage port, that probably is only going to last a day because the older the wine is, the more frail it is. But here's an important point. Even when you may not want to drink the port, if you have a little bit left in the bottle, it is absolutely phenomenal to cook with. So
really?
Even when port is past its prime for drinking, it is still wonderful at layering flavor into all kinds of dishes and stews and soups.
Wonderful. Karen, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
Karen McNeil's latest book is an update of her classic, The Wine Bible. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Now, you can find Karen's port picks and an excerpt from her port chapter at splendidtable.org. Coming up, we can talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it's time to turn to your calls. Get to us at 800-537-5252. And remember, we're on Facebook and Twitter, and you can send us an email, splendidtable.org. Nicole is calling from Portland, Oregon. Nicole, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about a Christmas gift for my mom. She is an excellent cook, and my dad tipped us off that she would really like to get a couple of cookbooks that are basically addressing lamb. She's never really cooked with lamb. And she got a Dutch oven last year for Christmas from us. And she wants also not only sort of cookbooks about lamb, but also maybe sauces to accompany with them, or just sort of generally meat dishes. And I was thinking about there's so many different options, right? There's Mediterranean lamb, which is different from Middle Eastern or Indian. And I have no idea where to begin.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. And I'm just trying to think. I can't offhand think of a book that focuses on lamb. You know, something done with a lot of thought and a lot of work. But there are some excellent meat books out there. Anything by Chris Slazenger and John Willoughby. They did a big book on meat. It's about how it's cut, how to identify it, how to handle it, what do you stew, what do you bake, you know, what do you roast.
And that sounds perfect.
It's a great, you know, it's sort of your meat guide, a basic book for the kitchen. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah,
yeah. That's one approach. And there may not be a ton of lamb recipes in there, but generally remember something. Almost anything you can do with beef, you can do with lamb, but you're going to cook it a shorter time just because the lamb is smaller. So, I mean, if you see, if there's a recipe that looks like it's just utterly delicious for a beef stew, it could easily be a lamb stew.
Perfect. That's such a great, yeah.
And by the way, Bruce Idels, Aidells, also has done a great meat book.
Great.
Okay, so can't find lamb itself, but these are going to be things that are going to give her a lot of information.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, she'll have the basics. That's what she wants.
Yeah. You're making my Christmas. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Take care.
Appreciate it.
Bye. Sarah's calling from Stuttgart, Germany. Sarah, welcome.
Hi there, Auntie Lynn. It's so good to talk to you. How are you?
I am good. I'm Auntie Lynn. Oh, that's so dear.
You are. Well, believe it or not, it's one step farther than that. You are probably the best friend that I just haven't met yet. So you are making a little dream of mine come true. It's so nice to talk to you.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, are you living in Germany permanently, or are you there as a student?
Actually, both. So my husband received a job here in Germany. He's here for 5 years, and we are making the most of it. So I'm also getting my bachelor's degree while my husband and I both work at the same time. So we just have all sorts of adventures going on right now.
Oh, this sounds exciting. Really exciting.
It really is. So and the food, oh my gosh, the food here is incredible. And believe it or not, that's exactly why I'm calling you.
Yes.
I am a Florida girl. And I didn't grow up with a lot of produce. I kind of grew up in a family where we had a lot of more processed things. And my husband and I, as we've gotten a little bit older, we're in our mid-30s, we're starting to be a bit more sustainable and seeing how many different ways we can actually incorporate local produce and sustainably grown produce and meats and all sorts of things into our diet. And we got over here, and I don't know what half of these things are. I'm this intimidated little girl who's looking at these morphed squashes and pumpkins and all sorts of produce that I've never seen and just going, I have no experience for this. I know the woman to call.
Okay, we'll take a shot. You know, who knows? Perfect. A miracle may happen here. No, but now tell me the kind of thing you're looking at now or that you're really curious about eating and cooking.
Right now, I'm running into cabbages, and we just had a cabbage festival for which they're known for. They actually harvest it, and they show it to you, and they give you all sorts of different kinds. They have conical cabbage, red cabbage, and then pumpkins and squashes that are just of all different kinds and
mm-hmm.
shapes.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of know butternut squash. I know acorn squashes, but I don't know what these others are, and They're all sorts of shapes I've never seen.
I know, I know. And they all taste slightly different. And I think, are any of them sold split, you know, in quarters or in halves? Because what I'm thinking is if you can get a wedge of them, you can
okay.
smell it. And that you can also just say, the heck with it, I'm going to buy this and I'm going to take it home. Because usually one of the great things to do with squash is mm-hmm. to bake it. And you can
okay.
you could even, if it's hard to cut, you could bake it whole and then until you can easily slip a knife into it and then split it, scoop out the seeds and taste the flesh. You may find all kinds of interesting flavors that you can puree and serve like sweet potatoes. Also, if you've got a squash and it's kind of bland, well,
mm-hmm.
here's where you pull out a little skillet. Maybe you take some of the local sausage or a bit of locally cured bacon, not a lot, but just a
mm-hmm.
bit, and you do some onion with that, and you do some mm-hmm. fresh thyme and a little mm-hmm. bit of rosemary, and then that gets mashed into this puree of squash, and you can serve it even with just a slightest drizzle of cream on it, not a lot. Or you can puree it. Add hot broth, add other vegetables, add whatever mm-hmm. seasonings you like. I mean, squash loves things like ginger, nutmeg, cinnamon, allspice, anything hot and peppery.
Oh,
also,
fantastic.
Almost every green herb works with squash. So,
really?
Yeah. And then if you're ambitious, what you can do is cut it into chunks instead of just baking the whole thing whole. And you can kind of candy them as you roast them. You coat them with a bit of honey and a little bit of vinegar and salt and pepper. And you slow roast them until they caramelize and they get soft. Don't make the chunks too big because they'll be raw on the inside by the time they're brown on the outside. But they'll be beautifully caramelized.
So, fantastic.
And with cabbage, one of the things that's fun to do with it is just coarse chop it any old way. Have a big pot of boiling water. Boil it just until it's tender. Drain it. And then this is my all-time favorite way of doing cabbage. Toss it with a bit of flavored vinegar, like sherry vinegar or apple cider vinegar and mm-hmm. black pepper. And if you want, just a few little bits of the sautéed bacon.
Brilliant.
It's fabulous. It's just fabulous. And it gives you a whole new take on cabbage.
Oh, that would be spectacular.
I think it'll work.
I'm so glad I called you. Thank you for taking my call.
That's all right. I love having a niece in Germany. It's really great
fun. I know. Well, more places to visit. I can even show you where to eat on top of a castle. If you need that in your life, feel free to come on over.
I have never, ever passed up the possibility of eating on top of a castle. You take care.
It's the little things in life.
Oh,
happy holidays.
Yeah. And to you. Enjoy the Christmas markets, boy.
Oh, yes, indeed. Thank you, friend. Bye-bye.
Take care, Sarah. Bye. Oh, Christmas in Germany. Quite the scene. I mean, really, fairyland stuff. Well, we're talking to you this hour. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Okay, we've got Jeremy calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Jeremy, what's up? Hello. What do you want to talk about?
I have some German Rumtopf in my basement right now.
Oh.
Not sure if you're familiar with that, but it's a concoction of seasonal fruit, sugar, and rum that I've been putting together since May of this year. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I spent some time in Germany, so I got turned on to this while I was there. And there are several cocktails and sweet preparations, but I'm trying to find probably a vegetarian and a pork option for a savory preparation as well.
Mm. So you're saying taking the Rumtopf fruit mixture and turning it into a savory that could be served with something like pork.
Exactly. I'm thinking it would make a good sauce somehow, but I'm just unsure about where to move forward with that.
I understand. Yeah, because it's very, very sweet. Maybe you should explain exactly how it's done, because a lot of people haven't heard of it.
Sure. So it's basically using a crock, and you're adding seasonal fruit as it comes into season. So my concoction has strawberries, cherries, plums, peaches. I think there's one other thing that's in there as well. And you're just adding sugar and a high-proof rum to that each time you add a new layer. So,
and it ferments.
Exactly. This is my first effort, so I'm not entirely sure if it's supposed to be swimming in rum. But the fruit has really absorbed a lot of that. So it's more almost like a jelly or preserve-like.
Oh, my. And the lid has not blown off the top of the crock.
Not yet.
Okay. Well, I think you've got a couple of options. First of all, if you get some of that into a saucepan, you boil it down a bit. And then what you do is you could really go sweet tart and do boiled down vinegar. For instance, if you were to take a cup of vinegar and boil it down by at least half or two-thirds, which mellows it, and then that goes in to about a cup and a half, 2 cups of your Rumtopf that you've cooked down already. And then you might add to that fresh ginger, black pepper, a bit of salt. Some people might even put in garlic. So you're making like a sweet, savory sauce for this. Grated orange or lemon rind to add a sparkle to it. And you feel your way through, because no two Rumtopfs are tasting alike.
Right.
But you want something acidic. You were looking at sweet tart now, so something acidic, but that you've softened by boiling it down.
Mm-hmm.
And then spices along with that you can cook in.
And I should mention, too, I've also added a stick of cinnamon and a couple of pods of star anise, too.
This is fabulous. You know what this is making me think of? It's Chinese cooking. Glazing a duck with the liquid, with that Rumtopf syrup and the addition of the vinegar, you could start brushing the duck toward the end of cooking so it glazes beautifully. And then using some of the fruit with short grain rice and a dash of soy sauce to make a steamed Chinese rice pudding. It's often called 8 treasure pudding. And I haven't made it in ages, but it comes out as this dome. And it can be sweet and savory, and it's just wonderful. But you could kind of do a takeoff on that. You steam rice and then toss it with that fruit and add maybe salted shelled pistachios and walnuts and that sort of thing. And then just heat that in the oven so it's fluffy and dry. And you serve the duck with that.
Yeah, that sounds like a winner.
I think that would really go over very well.
I've not experimented with duck before, so that'll be another part of the adventure there.
Yeah, with all those flavors, too. Think about this. Whenever you're making a pan sauce and you want to scrape up all those good bits and make a little bit of sauce, just take a little bit of that syrup with a bit of white wine or something that's dry. And you know, stir it in. It'll give you just that little hint. I think you can be nipping into that in small quantities and adding flavor to so many different things.
Well, I've got plenty of it, so there will be lots of experiments to come.
Okay. And you can keep adding to it, too, which is the great thing.
Absolutely.
Enjoy the Rumtopf.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Take care, Jeremy.
Okay.
Well, that's it for the week. Thanks for joining us. You have a great week, and however you're celebrating, may it be a delight. Let me leave you with this thought from Hamilton Wright Mabey, who said, "Blessed is the season which engages the whole world in a conspiracy of love." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Head to splendidtable.org to find information on anything you heard here this week. Get registered for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, subscribe to our weekly podcasts, and rifle through our collection of recipes, all ready for the holidays. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Alexandra Baumhart. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Special thanks to interpreter Esperanza Lopez Dominguez and to Anne-Marie Wagner from the Minneapolis Institute of Art. Thanks for tuning in. Have a wonderful holiday. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.